Welcome back to Minds Matter, a podcast sponsored by the Monash Centre for Consciousness and Contemplative Studies. I'm Beth.
And I'm Ava. And on Minds Matter, we explore research from neuroscience to psychology while occasionally talking through our own personal experiences.
And this week on the podcast, I spoke to Dr. Aniko Kushner, who is a postdoc at Monash. So she's someone that I work with. And her research is subjective experience and consciousness, but she focuses on dissociative experiences, and particularly in the disorders of depersonalization and derealization. So we talk a bit about what that is, how people have those experiences, and how it's hard to study subjective experiences. I hope you guys enjoy.
My name is Aniko Kushner, and I am a postdoctoral research fellow at Monash University. I am mostly interested in consciousness research. For my PhD, I have been working on dissociative experiences because they can be considered these changes in your conscious experience, in your subjective experience. And I was really fascinated by how they occur and how they can help us understand consciousness.
Some of your research looks at dissociation, and within that there are disorders where you experience more of this dissociation, which is derealization and depersonalization. Could you speak a little bit about those disorders and then what exactly this experience is? Because I feel like we can say, oh, I'm dissociating right now, but like, what actually is that?
Yes, I think this is a very interesting question. And to be honest, I'm not sure there's a concrete answer at the moment, because historically, dissociation has been actually around for a very long time. The first descriptions of dissociations are coming from the late 19th century. It has been around for a while, and it has been described very similarly as today, not entirely, but in some ways. Dissociation has been originally considered this kind of detachment, or there's a break in your experience, in your subjective experience, and maybe some aspects of it may becoming detached from it. So maybe you can't remember some aspects that you have been experiencing, or you can't process information as you usually do. Dissociative experiences have been explored and understood more. Specifically, depersonalization and derealization are a specific type of dissociative category. Depersonalization is the experience of detachment from yourself, from your body, and from your emotions. And derealization is the experience of detachment from your external environment. In a way, both of these experiences are considered as this type of dissociative experience, but then there are also other types of dissociative experiences, such as, for example, absorption, or there are also severe types of dissociative identity disorders that can be considered as a type of dissociation. And yeah, we understand more about some of these, we understand less about some of these, but they all share this aspect of your conscious experience being altered and some aspect of it being detached.
Okay, so the way I understand it now is, so there's dissociation, which is a category, and within that there's these different ones. And would a good example of dissociation be perhaps like when you're driving and you zone out?
That's a very interesting question, because I think there's some disagreement within the field. Some people define dissociative experiences differently, and maybe there's also in the way how people have recently started to use this term is a bit different. In the general public, people say that, oh, I'm dissociating when they just zone out, when they just not able to recollect what was going on, or they are completely kind of feel detached from their environment. And then maybe that would be something that we can call as mind blanking. So when you don't have any report, or you're not able to report your mental content and what was going on in the preceding few seconds. And I would say that maybe not every researcher would agree that that's a dissociation, or that's a dissociative experience. But then personally, I would say so. But again, this is just my opinion. Dissociative experiences can be like, for example, you just woke up in a hotel room after like a long flight, and then you suddenly you are unable to kind of know what's going on, and you feel like you're unsure whether something is a dream or not. Also, dissociative experience can be like you're not experiencing any emotional response. Maybe you are overwhelmed. Maybe you're watching a movie and then you just don't experience anything. That's the way you usually experience things. You also have dissociative experiences, specifically derealization happening. For example, if some people are sick or have a migraine, also if they are using some psychoactive substance, a very typical case for dissociation is during acute stress or, for example, a panic attack. So you may feel completely out of your body, or you feel like completely locked in your body and distant from your environment. And in general, there's a lot of different ways how you can become dissociated. So then it becomes this question of how do we exactly define dissociation? How do we exactly draw this circle around the concept, which I have been kind of working on during my PhD and trying to figure out? It's an interesting question.
Is dissociation necessarily a bad thing? Is it a good or a bad thing? Probably my guess is like it's not binary, like lots of things. And then can anyone experience these? Is it related more to psychiatric disorders? How does it fit in with our experience? Is there something that makes you more likely to have more of these experiences?
Yes, again, these are very good questions. I will just go on. I think maybe one of the surprising things for me when I started to look into dissociation and derealization and depersonalization specifically, I realized it is actually very common. Some studies that are trying to assess the prevalence of dissociation and, for example, derealization and depersonalization, say that up to 70 or 80% of people report experiencing it at least once in their lifetime. During my PhD, we collected data from online participants. At several steps, at several iterations, we have found that around 15 to 20% of the people tend to report having dissociative experiences that you would consider clinically relevant. So clinically, it's the same degree as you would see in people that are diagnosed with depersonalization and derealization disorder and that are being treated in a psychiatric clinic or just that have this diagnosis. So then it becomes this strange thing where dissociative experiences are treated as these strange, weird things that only happen during traumatic events and only a minor subset of the population experiences it, which be true in some ways. So depersonalization and derealization disorder, I think it's only affecting maybe around 1 to 2% of the population as like its own organic disorder. But the experiences are very prevalent and they can be caused by many different things. And yes, they actually have a strong connection or correlation with psychiatric disorders. So I mentioned before, for example, panic disorder or panic attacks very often bring on dissociative experiences, but also people can experience them during depressive episodes. They are associated with PTSD. Some people experience it when they have a schizophrenia diagnosis in many different ways, generalized anxiety. So yeah, a tricky question. To answer the other question that you mentioned, whether it's a typical thing to experience, how should we consider this? I think dissociation has been misunderstood and has been treated as this very severe and very static state that people are in and they are unable to get out of it. And it can be like that, and that's very disturbing for the person. But then at the same time, I do think that we may need to reconsider dissociation as something that our conscious experience is capable of. And sometimes we are in this state and then sometimes we go out of it. And there is a lot of potential in understanding how these switches occur and also just in general, making people familiar with these experiences. Because one of the very crucial issues with our current understanding of dissociation is that most people are not familiar with it. And then when they experience these symptoms, they feel like, oh, am I going crazy? What's going on? Am I going to stay like this forever? And then also maybe general practitioners are maybe not familiar with these. So there's a lack of knowledge and a lack of understanding. And I think if you know how to name things, if you know that, okay, yes, I'm having a dissociative experience and I know how to understand it, that can already be a helpful thing.
I have so many questions, but another question I have is, so I feel like when anyone comes on and they talk about something about consciousness, one of the things that naturally comes up is, well, do animals experience it?
Yeah.
So do animals have dissociative experiences? Do we know?
And I think that's also an interesting question from a general theoretical or methodological perspective. It's dissociation. It is defined as this change in your subjective experience. So we don't really have a clear behavioral marker for that. And that was, for example, a project I was working on when I started my PhD. I had this little secret goal that I would find a behavioral correlate of dissociation. And I specifically focused on derealization, and I tried to create this task where people can kind of assess realness of certain images. And I was hoping that maybe that could be a way how we can measure and we can find a behavioral correlate for experiencing dissociation, experiencing derealization. But then in the end, we didn't really see any difference between people who say that they are experiencing derealization right now versus people who don't experience it, they are not experiencing those symptoms. Then it becomes this question, like, what can be, how can we find a behavioral correlate for dissociative experiences? In order to have any kind of animal model, we would need something like that. And I'm not aware of anything like that.
Is there a neural correlate?
Yes. So interestingly, there's much more work that has been done on finding neural correlates. And it has been mostly done on patients with depersonalization disorder. And the general understanding or the general theory about the mechanism is that there is a top-down, like an upregulation of prefrontal cortex and a downregulation of emotional responses and limbic areas. Basically, your prefrontal cortex suppresses, and also the insular cortex is being suppressed. And so there is a downregulation of bodily signals,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of creates these experiences. Then again, these studies are done on patients, and it's very difficult to know where do these regions, alterations, so how do these functions actually relate to the subjective experience?
Yeah, that makes sense. I just have one more question, and then we'll go into the research that you've done. So say you're having a lot of these experiences and you're seeing a doctor to treat them. Is it, like, if it's not causing you any distress, is this even something you should treat? So I'm not saying, like, oh, you need to stop these experiences, because I definitely have them in a non-distressing way. But just say you go to the doctor and you're like, I want to stop having these. What kind of treatments, because, you know, if you're having a panic attack, maybe you're prescribed Valium. Is Valium going to provide? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's quite strange. And especially, as I mentioned, since the concept of dissociation has been around for close to 150 years now, still, we don't have well-established treatment. So there are some studies with specific medication, but it's not very consistent. It doesn't necessarily work on everyone. There are some promising studies on cognitive behavioral therapy, but again, it doesn't work on everyone. There's also some people who are trying to look into meditation, like embodiment and bodily, to basically try to connect with your own body through maybe, for example, dance therapy or something like that. But then as far as I know, there's no magic pill or something that everyone would say that, yes. For example, with depression, people often say that, okay, serotonin or SSRIs are kind of like first-line treatment. I don't think we have anything like that with dissociation, and I don't think we are anywhere close to actually having that, unfortunately. Right now, we are just really not understanding how these experiences emerge and why they emerge, and then also what can we do to, if someone wants to treat them.
It's so cool. I love these areas of neuroscience where we just don't know, especially when it comes to the consciousness stuff that obviously is
who we are. And it's like, well, we have this thing. What causes it? I don't know. What can you treat it with? I don't know. What's happening? Well, we just don't know.
Exactly.
It's crazy. That's so interesting. Well, given that we've just worked out we don't know anything, so in your PhD, you did research this. Yes. Can you explain what studies you ran? How do you even begin to research something like this?
Yes. So I think it is worth it for me to kind of give some larger context on that, because I started my PhD during COVID. Originally, my PhD plan was something not completely different. I wanted to study derealization and depersonalization, but because COVID hit, I had to reorganize my research plan, and that's how I came up with this online experiment. But yes, so as I mentioned before, I was basically very interested in figuring out if we can somehow behaviorally or find a behavioral correlate or some kind of functional difference in people experiencing dissociative symptoms. And so we have done two different projects. One of them was focusing on derealization, and we looked at how your perceptual experience may be changed when you're experiencing derealization. And interestingly, we didn't really find a consistent change. So at least on the behavioral level, people seem to assess perceptual features such as vividness very similarly, regardless whether they experience derealization or not. And another study I was working on is about emotional numbing or emotional numbness, the lack of emotional reactions and kind of emotional responses to external stimuli is a very typical symptom of depersonalization. And then we wanted to see whether is there actually an association between people saying that they are not experiencing emotional responses and what happens when we actually show them different videos meant to induce emotions. We are still collecting, because we have been doing a registered report for this study, so we are still collecting the stage 2 version, but the initial data doesn't really show a clear effect. So we have this weird bifurcation of subjective experience and then behavioral correlates, which I find very exciting, because it means that there is this gap that we don't understand. It is a quite critical point of inquiry.
Because that's what I was going to say. With both of those, not finding a difference is kind of exciting in itself, right? Because it's like, well, wow, if there's this really big difference in subjectively how we're feeling, but you can't measure it with these things that seem to be related.
Exactly. And I think it's really kind of points towards the importance of thinking about consciousness and thinking about subjective experience as its own thing, and also not necessarily equating your conscious experience with your behavior. So again, you might be able to function very well, but then at the same time, you may experience very severe depression symptoms. So just because you're functioning, does your subjective experience, it doesn't count. It is actually very important. And I'm really hoping that our work and also other ongoing work in this field can highlight this discrepancy. I think focusing on the subjective experience of people and also trying to improve that should be an important consideration for any kind of psychiatric, but also in general lifestyle and general health considerations. Because just because you are able to do something, it doesn't mean that you are not experiencing something potentially very distressing. And we do need to address that as well.
Oh, it's so cool. Because I was just thinking, if dissociation is so prevalent in so many people, like people are functioning. Yeah. It probably kind of makes sense that you don't see these big differences in behavior because if your behavior or outcome of that experience was you couldn't do anything, then it probably wouldn't be as prevalent.
No, and then also just, we don't know how much is it like compensatory mechanisms, but also, you know, sometimes people are able to function in very different ways, and we also need to explore that with a focus on subjective experiences. Another study I was working on was about mind wandering and mind blanking. So it is related to this kind of zoning out experiences when you're doing a task. And we have been trying to see whether we can, we have done an EEG fMRI study. So we put people in an MR scanner, we put an EEG cap on them, and then we ask them to do this very boring task. And then occasionally we ask them to report whether they are paying attention to the task or if they are mind wandering, so they are thinking about something else. One thing that I was actually quite surprised is how diverse was our sample. We had participants who experienced mind wandering very frequently, basically almost the whole time. Some in like, there is a behavioral effect. If you mind wander or if you zone out, there is a decrease in reaction times, so there is a decrease in accuracy, but it's not like a complete lack of ability to complete a task, which is again in line with what I'm experiencing. Like, we are able to function even if we are thinking about something else. But yet this is, I think, a very exciting kind of a shift, divergence between what you're subjectively experiencing and what the behavioral outcome measure can show you. Yes, I think that would be, it is a very kind of exciting area to poke around.
That's so cool. So with the mind blanking and mind wandering, how often do people experience it? And this could be folk psychology or folk neuroscience or fake news. You know how they say sometimes, I remember when we were doing maths exams, they were like, oh, read the question and then go back to it because your brain will still be working it out. Like, if, I don't know if that's true or not.
Me neither.
But could it be if we're mind wandering and mind blanking, even if we're not conscious of something that our mind is figuring out, we could be doing it?
Potentially. But then again, I don't know. I do think there is a connection between mind wandering and creativity. And there are some theories about like, yeah. But then also, and there's, I think, a general experience of like, sometimes you figure out a solution while you're in the shower or while you're taking a walk, because suddenly when you're not thinking about something, you gain insight. But then, yeah, it's also one of these areas where there's a lot of different research and a lot of gaps in our knowledge. So to answer the frequency question, in general, I think people report to spend maybe 1/3 to 50% of their time mind wandering.
In the general day?
Yeah. I think in the general day, if you measure with experience sampling, so if you just randomly poke someone and, hey, tell me what you're experiencing right now, I think it can be also maybe 2/3.
Like, we're really not present at all, are we?
We are actually just in our head all the time. Again, surprisingly, and we are able to function very well. And then even our tasks, so we actually had 40%, roughly 40% of the time when we asked people, they reported mind wandering, so thinking about something else, and then around 10% was mind blanking. So couldn't recall what was going on. They were just completely zoned out. These are average numbers across our participants. We had a very high variability. We have people who never experience mind blanking. Sometimes I get these people of like, what do you mean mind blanking? Has it ever happened to people that they don't think about like anything? How does that even work? And then I'm in this position where I'm like, some people do seem to recall or seem to report that they are not experiencing anything. They are just zoning out. And some people do it, and some people do it more often, and other people don't. So even when you're tired, for example, we see some connection with sleepiness. What we have been kind of looking at is increased brain patterns. Brain patterns in the brain seem to predict these mind wandering and mind blanking.
I think like Anika and I discussing this actually brings up another point I had, is like how you communicate what a subjective experience is to someone and measure that, because I'm a bit confused by that. But is it nothing? Is mind blanking nothing? Because that feels like just the void. I'm always avoiding that. I don't want to look into that. So
yeah, I mean, I think there's a huge methodological and theoretical questions about how can we define mind. Like, how can you also report mind blanking, and how long, like, how do you even know? I think, yeah, it's a difficult question. And there are a lot of people trying to work it out. But then, in the end, if someone says that I was just zoning out, I wasn't experiencing anything, we have no way to really validate that, obviously, because it's their own subjective experience. And to me, it makes sense to accept that, yes, that's their experience. I think it's similar to, for example, aphantasia, where some years ago we realized that there are people who are not really able to imagine things. And then we have been kind of just, I think, people who are able to have like visual, they can't even imagine what is it like to exist in the world without that. And so then for people who actually don't have that, they just feel like, what do you mean? Yeah, I just exist in the world and I don't imagine like counting sheep, for example.
Yeah.
It's just a phrase that people say.
It's just, who's doing that? And because with the mind blanking, I just don't know if I ever have nothing. I dream a lot. So even when I wake up from sleeping, there's always, I don't know. So I don't know if I experience nothing. And actually, because Aniko and I are really good friends and we have a lot of colleagues in common, I think I know some people who've spoken to you and who have said, what's mind blanking? And so, yeah, I think I know also the personality types that never.
Exactly. Which is, again, I think it's very fascinating. And it just shows that like our subjective experience, there's so much diversity in our subjective experience. And I really hope to kind of explore that in the future. And also just to, I don't know, I would really like to raise awareness of it and just to inspire more research into this. Because when you are only considering your own subjective experience, you are missing out on so many different perspectives and you are missing out on so many different ways to see the world, to interact with the world. Yeah, a lot of things that we could do differently and we could experience differently.
I can also see how your work and ways of thinking about subjective experience would be so impactful in psychiatry, because I feel like it does always come with these symptoms and outcomes and measurements, and that's kind of the field. And I think it's been really cool to hear you speak about, you know, we can have these inner experiences that make up what we experience that isn't measured in this outcome way. Interesting to think about.
Yeah. And I think obviously we want to try to find some ways to measure it, and maybe it's possible, maybe it's not, but it's definitely worthy pursuit to try to find something, because once we have a very precise measurement or a way to actually identify things, then we can more easily develop treatments and evaluate treatments as well. I don't think disregarding subjective experience is a strategy that we can continue within psychology and psychiatry. Also, just because people are more and more familiar with these experiences, I have seen people on TikTok mentioning dissociating, which is strange and funny, but also very cool. People are having these experiences. And we need to understand it, because it is something that affects people.
This is just a little insight. When Aniko and I went out with my friend once, who's an artist, I remember we were speaking about Aniko's work with him, and it was really cool because we were asking, he's a photographer, and how this is a really amazing photographer. And he kind of, can you remember this?
Yeah.
And he kind of was talking about like, well, it's a feeling. And you're like, oh, that's so interesting, because it kind of is similar to these.
Yeah.
It wasn't like he's fully associated at all.
Yeah.
And then he makes these beautiful.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think that's also another aspect with dissociation, where because it has been treated as a response to trauma that is very scary and that is within the domain of a psychiatric disorder and a psychiatric condition, I haven't really seen a lot of work on what is the advantage of dissociation? Yeah. When is it maybe useful? And how can you, for example, have a dissociative experience and then have a positive outcome because of that? Dissociating, maybe kind of retreating into your mind, can be very useful in a traumatic event because you can protect yourself. But then maybe it can be also useful in other conditions, in other states where you maybe need to work out something, or maybe it's also doesn't necessarily need to be a self-protective thing. Maybe it can be something that you are actually trying to cultivate or trying to see. And then there's this very complicated and somewhat controversial topic and connection between dissociative experiences and meditation. Some meditative practices are trying to make people become aware of their emotional processes and then kind of observe them as this thing that doesn't affect them, which is very similar in some ways to dissociative experiences, because you are no longer affected in dissociation. You are not affected by whatever happens to you. Nothing seems to actually get to you. So there is this interesting tension there, whether meditative practices or some meditative practices, are they actually trying to cultivate us a form of dissociation? Is it right to connect these two phenomena? Also, for example, ego dissolution under when people are using some psychoactive drugs. Ego dissolution has very strangely similar, at least to some degree, similar features to depersonalization or derealization. But then in both of these examples, like ego dissolution and meditation, they are usually experienced as a positive thing, or at mm-hmm. least not a negative. It's more rare for these experiences to have a negative connotation, a negative emotional state attached to them, while dissociation tends to be more negative. People tend to be quite distressed by it, which is again itself an interesting question. When you say that you're not really experiencing emotions or emotional responses, but at the same time you are distressed about it, what does
like
that mean?
Because that yeah. like that's
it's really fascinating.
Oh, it's so interesting. Consciousness is such a big topic, obviously.
Yes, a lot to do and a lot that we don't understand, which is good for me because I can just keep writing my little papers
chipping away
for many, many years, hopefully.
So, Ava, have you had dissociative experiences?
Intense. I feel like the way we're talking about it, you could probably tell that we haven't really, because we're like, ha, ha, ha. I feel like it's, like, I know people who've had dissociative experiences, especially depersonalization, and it's very intense and is, like, a very dark period in their lives, and I have never experienced something like that. But I think it was interesting listening to the episode because I did see it as something that's like very intense and kind of like a disorder, kind of in the ways that we've talked about before of like, you know, you wouldn't call being really into social media as an addiction the same way that you could be addicted to a substance. So I feel like I had this kind of, I don't know if the word is like respect or like intimidation for a term like that, where it's something that I also feel like in everyday speech, you know how people will be like, oh, I'm dissociating right now. I feel like that's one of those things where it feels, I thought it was weird for people to say that because it sounds like taking a clinical term and taking some of the power out of it. But from what I understood from Nico's research, it sounds like maybe that's not the case and people actually do dissociate. Like, there's no clear definition, and it's just kind of this idea of a change in your conscious or subjective experience that's where it's not really clear actually what the boundaries are. Is that right?
Yeah, I feel like speaking to Aniko, this is one of those situations where the pop culture reference of something is actually okay, and it's not taking, you know, misusing something that's associated with a psychiatric disorder in everyday terms. And it is something that there's a range of experiences you can have and everyone can experience them. And you can describe it as that. So yeah, I didn't think it was one of these situations where it's like, oh, we say this and we're not actually experiencing that because it is our own experience. And I think that I do dissociate.
Okay, say more.
I remember once I was driving with some people, and it was like the car was stressful. There were kids in it, and I don't know, it was just like a lot going on. They were talking to me and I like wasn't responding. And I was like, oh, sorry, I'm just disassociating. And they're like, let us know when you're back associating with us.
Wait, like you actually, what was the experience? Like you couldn't hear them?
Or just I'm not so not present. I'm just in another. So I don't know. I guess it kind of feels a bit similar to daydreaming, but just not present in that moment at all.
That's interesting.
And then I came, yeah.
But I feel like you're normally very present. Is that true?
Have you ever had the thing where I just like look off and feel a bit? Maybe
like seeing you do that?
Yeah.
But I feel like maybe, but I don't think I would have noticed, as because I think it's like it kind of happens to everyone. And I don't know, something about calling that dissociation also feels weird in the sense of, I guess then, because it seems so different from like someone forgetting, you know, what they just experienced, like if they just had a fight with their spouse or something and they're like fully dissociated and they kind of almost become a different person and their consciousness kind of becomes split. Like that seems like such a different experience that putting them together feels like maybe there's something in that that's not as useful, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think I thought that the spectrum is like, yeah, these really extreme cases where you completely forget something, like the case you just mentioned, and then these little cases where it's like, oh wait, am I in a car and kids are yelling in the back? I don't even know, because I'm like, yeah, I'm just like, can't deal with this.
Yeah, so that's kind of intense.
There was a spectrum, and because from the way I can understand Aniko's work and looking at these subjective experiences, is they're all going to be these extreme spectrums, and that's okay.
Okay, the am I in a car is kind of, that sounds worse than what I thought. So I don't think that's ever happened to me. I feel like when I was younger, I used to dissociate, but I don't think I would call it that, where like I just felt like the quality of my experience was kind of not real, like to get through a day or something. That sounds bad, but like where like a day would feel very hazy and like I wasn't fully there in some ways. And now maybe I think it was a form of dissociation, but I don't know. I guess because it didn't feel that serious, I wouldn't call it that, but I think it was more generally, because I would feel like that kind of a lot, actually. But, ooh. Oh. I feel like it was generally like a thing where it was tied to well-being of not being as happy and present, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but I think that that's, again, that's okay and can fit on the same spectrum. And I feel like that's also like with other things, like even with anxiety, for example, you know, some people will experience small little bits of anxiety that are fine and don't contribute to in a way that affects their life. And so that's on the like really lower end of the spectrum, because, you know, we're going to have experienced lots of feelings and emotions, and that's just who we are. But then it's like, well, has it become to a level that's impacting your well-being? And I feel like with this dissociation, it's the same. So perhaps young Ava, it was impacting your well-being, question mark. But like that can be on the same spectrum of me not knowing if I'm in a car or...
That one sounds really bad, actually.
I wasn't driving.
Still? I don't know. That's intense. I think the only times that I've experienced it, and I don't think I've experienced as much depersonalization, but I feel like the derealization aspect, I actually feel that because, you know, I tend to overstimulate, and I feel like a lot of people overstimulate. Like, there's constantly, like, some input that you have, like, scrolling, and, like, you have your TikTok just going, or you have a podcast on. Maybe that's you right now, listening to this podcast, doing something else, that I feel like that is my reality a lot of the times. And then, you know, when I try to practice mindfulness, like, sometimes I'll be sitting there, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to practice mindfulness in this moment. But then because I'm, like, really trying to focus on the present, it almost feels weird because I'm doing that. Does that make sense? Like, because my new baseline is this constant overstimulation, then there feels like there's this shift in conscious experience that makes the situation feel less real, even though I'm more present in it, because that's not my baseline norm of reality, which seems kind of counterintuitive.
But I think that's such a cool point where, yeah, everything will be relative to your own. So all your different experiences and emotions you feel are going to be relative to your own experiences and emotions. So if your baseline is super engaged and attention on all these different things going on, maybe a small step away from that feels more bigger than it is for someone who's not, that's not their baseline. I think that that's a really cool point.
But I think it's kind of scary because I feel like every time I try to do mindfulness in a way because there's nothing there, I also get really overwhelmed because I kind of realize how much I mute when I'm like, oh, I'm just going to try to pay attention to the sounds around me. Where normally, you know, I have something playing and three screens on or something. And then I'm like, oh my God, I can hear my footsteps and the birds and maybe I can hear the ocean. You can tell I live in Santa Barbara. And I'm like, oh, like, this is too much. You know what I mean? Even though usually I'm completely drowning that out. I feel like those are the moments where I have the realization where I'm like, this is crazy, even though it's the opposite of what I should be feeling. I feel like that's, you're not well.
That's why it's good to have Aniko as a friend, because anytime I have an experience, I like tell her, I'm like, hey, this is going on. And she will tell me like, what's up? I recently just went for my driver's license and I got it. Yeah, that's good.
Yay. We both have driver's licenses now. When we started this podcast, neither of us did.
Look at us go. But that's how I kind of lost my mind before getting it. I was so stressed and so, I don't know, it was all very weird. And I had this thing where I was so overwhelmed. The colors of the world seemed a little dim. And I told Aniko and she was, I want to know. She was just like, so I want to know more about that, because that's one of those experiences. Just because I was so stressed about this stupid test, everything just felt, yeah. And that was like, and that was just caused by a really stressful time.
The fact that also that you notice those things, yeah, in a way, I think that is maybe part of something that people lose when they're like me and they're overstimulated. Because I feel like you're also very in touch with your emotions and your conscious experience. And I think that kind of meta awareness of this is happening is, I guess, probably useful. But I think it's something that people really don't have as much access to anymore now because we're overloading ourselves all the time.
It's also funny, I feel, even with the awareness of it, that doesn't actually seem to be able to stop it.
Yeah, I feel like that makes it almost worse that you're aware of it, you know?
Yeah.
Because you're aware of it.
You're like, oh my God.
Yeah. Because maybe there are times at which that would happen to me, but my reaction is to do everything to stop that as a coping mechanism. So I would be like, oh, I'm just going to like overload my senses so I don't have to. Yeah, so I don't have to actually experience the derealization because I'm going to control it myself. Like, I'm going to bring it on to myself. I'm just going to remove myself from reality consciously. I just kind of wonder if the different groups of people that she could test looking at this, and if you would see a difference in like also how often people feel like it's happening to them. Because I do think there's a group of people who are always online or on a screen where you can kind of control the derealization you're having rather than have it brought on by your mind. So we started by me saying, I don't think this has ever happened to me. And we're ending by me saying, I actually do it to myself constantly. Because I was like, I'm not consciously aware of these things, but I'm actually consciously bringing it on myself.
Would you just like to finish by letting us know what's coming up next? What are you excited about?
Yeah, so at the moment, I am just finishing up some of these papers that I have been working on for my PhD. So hopefully this year will be the year when I'm going to finish all of these papers. And yes, I'm also quite interested in kind of developing these ideas. I am working on a more theoretical paper that should be coming out again in a few months, where we try to argue a very similar perspective that I was just mentioning about dissociation being a more kind of transient and but also like potentially transient, but also like it's more about a structural change in your experience. And yeah, that it can be a very interesting topic for consciousness research. So I'm very excited to have that paper out very soon.
Yay!
Thank you to Dr. Aniko Kostor for joining us this episode. Our intro and outro music is Nobody Stayed for the DJ by Glacio. Our transition music is Back for More, also by Glacio.
Minds Matter is created and co-hosted by Beth Fisher, she's the Australian one, and me, Ava Madasouza.
You can find social media content on our Instagram at Minds Matter Podcast and TikTok at Minds Matter Pod,
created this week by Monica Lee. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode, but in the meantime, find all our episodes and show notes on mindsmatterpodcast.com.